Inside Crime is brought to you by DoTerra. The DoTerra drug deactivation system helps stop opioid misuse before it starts. With DoTerra, unused prescription opioids and other drugs are gone for good. I'm Angeline Hartman. As a journalist, I've worked with cops and victims of crime all over the country. My craft is storytelling. My passion is crime fighting. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Inside Crime. On today's episode, we're going to talk to a man who's become known as one of the most daring undercover agents in history. For 27 years, Jay Dobbins was a special agent with the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. He retired in 2014 and has since become a New York Times best-selling author. He's a highly sought-after public speaker. He's involved in TV and movies and several other projects. Jay Dobbins is a big draw because of his experience in violent crime investigations as an undercover operative. During his career, he conducted hundreds of undercover operations. He often played the role of a hitman or mob debt collector. And he infiltrated all kinds of deadly criminal enterprises, anti-government extremists, gun running groups, drug traffickers, organized crime syndicates. The list is very long. He is best known for his case against the notorious Hells Angels Motorcycle Club. In that, he used a unique investigative technique, staging a murder. We're going to talk to him about what it was like inside that 21-month operation. It was called Operation Black Biscuit, and Jay Dobbins says it almost cost him his family, his sanity, and his life. First, a quick glimpse into the Hells Angels from a History Channel documentary.
Their reign is fueled by sheer terror.
We had something like 160 bodies piled up. It was a bloodbath.
You use hunter strategy in this game. It's predators and prey all the way.
The Hells Angels will do anything to eliminate their competition.
It was basically just open season.
They'll stop at nothing to control the flow of drugs into the U.S.
It's better to join with the Hells Angels than get a bullet in the head.
Such a pleasure to have on our show today, Jay Dobbins. Jay, welcome to Inside Crime.
Thank you for having me and welcome to your audience as well. Thank you.
You have had such an amazing career, and there's so much to talk about. You've done many undercover operations in your career. Hundreds, right?
Well, yeah. Over the course of my 27 years as a federal agent, I was involved in over 500 undercover operations. There's one that gains everybody's attention. It's the Hells Angels infiltration. And I say all the time, I tell people all the time that that is not the case or the investigation that I am most proud of. I don't think it was my best work, but it got a lot of publicity, not so much for what I did or for what our task force accomplished, but more who it was on. It was on the Hells Angels. They're Americana. They're sexy. You've got the Sons of Anarchy. You've got the Mayan shows. Everybody's intrigued by these guys. The Hells Angels are the king of the mountain in the outlaw biker culture. What made that case popular, what brought attention to it, is not as much what we did, it's who we did it against.
When you say that, you mean there are other cases that are stronger or more successful?
There are other cases that I worked on that I am personally prouder of, that I believe made a greater impact, had a bigger influence on public safety. It depends on what box we want to put it in. If we're looking strictly at infiltration stories, then that's a pretty big one, because the Hell's Angels were believed to be impenetrable. When we started this case and we started running on the Hell's Angels, pretty much everybody, including the experts, were like, this is impossible. At the time, the Hell's Angels were in existence for 60 plus years. There'd been numerous attempts to get under their wire that had been unsuccessful. And so people were like, this is impossible. And we looked at it more like, you know what? Let's not use the term impossible. It's improbable, but let's try. And I think that that, when I look at my career and I look at my undercover work, I wasn't the best undercover operator out there. I wasn't Donnie Brasco part two. I can name dozens of my friends and peers who were better undercover operatives than I was. The thing I had going for me is I was always willing. I was always willing to try. Sometimes I failed, sometimes I succeeded, but I was always willing to take cases that other people didn't want. The nasty, dirty, impossible, improbable cases, I was always willing to take a shot at those.
So when we're talking about this case, you do understand why people want to talk about it. They're interested in it. They're fascinated with it.
Absolutely.
And your work with it.
You know, when we look at the big picture of the Hell's Angels, they are literally a part of the fabric of America. They are an international crime syndicate who has become Americana. Syndicates and crime organizations come to the United States because we have money here. There are opportunities for traditional mafia, Russian organized crime, the triads, various organized crime groups come to America for the opportunities to make money. The biker culture, led by the Hell's Angels, is America's export to the world of organized crime. It's homegrown. It's ours. It started here. The biker culture started here in America, and it's spread across the world, and people are intrigued by that. I fully understand why.
Well, I do think, though, there are some people, maybe you can just give us a quick, you know, synopsis of what it is they do. What, I mean, is it about drugs? Is it about power? What is it? Because I think people, there are lots of communities across America that maybe they've heard of you know, these biker gangs, but they don't really understand the impact on these societies that have been touched by this.
They're no different than any other gang, from a street gang to the highest levels of organized crime. It's about territory. It's about money. It's about power. And that's what they do. That's why they expand into other territories, because like with any gang, control of real estate gives you the opportunity to make money within those areas that you control. You know, you look at the structure of the gang, they're really not all that different in the big picture than, say, even like Crips and Bloods. Mm-hmm. They wear vests. They wear, we call them cuts. They wear cuts that label them, that tell the world who they belong to. Just like Crips and Bloods wear red and blue. They fight for territory. Like Crips and Bloods fight for a street corner. These guys fight for areas of influence.
Yeah.
And it all comes down to money and whatever means mechanism is needed to generate money. That's what their motivation is.
Operation Black Biscuit. What was the goal? What was the point of Operation Black Biscuit? Was there a time frame or certain, you know, a few key players that were the focus of that? Or,
well, the violence of the Hell's Angels on the West Coast had gone through the roof, and they were operating with impunity. They had been at a war with the Mongols motorcycle gang, another California-based motorcycle gang, for 25 plus years of this bloodbath that for the most part, had stayed internal. Then in April of 2002, there was a shootout at a casino in Laughlin, Nevada, at the Harrah's Casino, where these, the Hells Angels and the Mongols got into a full-on, the equivalent of a prison yard riot, but they did it on the floor of the Harrah's Casino in Laughlin, and it was captured. You know, so they're brawling under hundreds of surveillance cameras. There's three people killed, murdered during the riot, dozens more injured and stabbed and beaten and shot. And that brought big attention to these guys. And we had already started our operations at that point. What that did, what that event did, is it fueled our case and it empowered our case. And it made, in the eyes of executives, in the eyes of managers, what was just a traditional undercover infiltration type case, all of a sudden became very important because it was driven by national exposure.
How did it all start?
Let me back up a little bit. I was an agent for ATF, which is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We have jurisdiction over the federal firearms laws, federal explosives laws, arson laws. We have narcotics jurisdiction. And because of that jurisdiction, like the violent crime statutes all fall under ATF's control. And so ATF, in essence, has become the federal violent crime police. Our targets in this case were violent, and the means and methods they used to create their violence were a hand and glove for what ATF did. They used guns and bombs and arson and violence and drug trafficking and gun running and murder and rape and extortion and any violent method that you can imagine to run your gang and to gain control and power was within what these guys did, how they operated, how they conducted themselves. So it was a perfect match.
You know, Jay, as I hear you describe all of that and break it down for us, I mean, it is, I'm sure, hard to imagine for a lot of people across America, such violence and such terror. I mean, you see that kind of stuff when you go to the movies, right? And you're talking about real life.
Well, I think that from my personal perspective, the entertainment industry, movies, television, books, magazines, newspapers, and they to some extent glamorize that world. They make it sexy and they make it risky and dangerous. And anybody who's lived it, anybody who's touched it on either side of the law, realizes that it's not sexy. It's a nasty, dirty, bloody, vomit-covered scab of a life. And that's the reality of it. We watch TV, and we see like that Miami Vice type vibe that's presented out there, you know, and you see these beautiful, glamorous women like walking around this world. The reality of it is, at least in my world, those women were like straight skanks with three teeth in their head and tits like sweat socks with rocks in the toes, right? It's not sexy. It's not glamorous. It's not beautiful. It's a dangerous, nasty world, and it's inhabited by people who have their PhDs in violence and intimidation.
Wow, Jay. Huh. Just to be clear, so you were in that world, and then you'd come home at night or on weekends, or you know what I mean? Like, how did that work?
Well, you know, I came home sporadically. I came home when I was able, and to be quite honest with you, I'm not proud of this. I'm actually, in hindsight, I'm actually ashamed of it. I came home when I had to, not when I could, or not when I wanted to, because I was so into my role, there was a time in my life where I preferred to be hanging out with gangsters and thugs and murderers and rapists. I chose that over my own family, over my own wife and kids and home.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, I could totally understand how that would happen. You're entrenched in a certain world, and then there's a transition, I imagine, right? And then so to go back and forth, that would must be exhausting, number one. And just to interweave the two worlds, it sounds impossible.
I would come home and I would do the bare minimum that I had to do to keep my household functioning. I'd mow the grass, pay the bills, pat the kids on the head, have a cup of coffee with my wife, and I couldn't wait to get back into gangster land. I couldn't wait to get back to these guys. And I would come home and my wife would say, "You can't pop in here and treat us like we're your suspects. You can't treat us like we're criminals." And then in my defense, I would answer, "I'm not a light switch. I can't turn this off and on. People who dabble in what I do for a living get dead. I have to be all in." And then her response was, "Well, then when you come to this house, if you're not a light switch, you better install a dimmer, because you don't get to come home and treat us like we're gangsters."
I totally get it. I totally get why you were immersed in it and it was hard to change over.
Well, you know, I say this with humility. And like I said, I have no satisfaction or no pride in this, in that during that time in my life, I'm actually embarrassed by it, humiliated by it. I abandoned my family. I abandoned my wife and my kids. And in essence, I betrayed them in exchange for an investigation. At the time, I felt like it was a decision that I had to make, and I justified it to myself. In hindsight, the amount of battle damage that I created on my family was huge, because I left them alone.
I'm sure before you started all this, you know, your bosses must have said to you, make sure you talk to your family, make sure your family's all in. Everybody is impacted by, you know, when you have a job like this. It's no different than somebody who's going off in the military being deployed. Obviously, the family's left behind. All of a sudden, the wife at home has to take care of everything, right? He doesn't come back every so often. He's gone for 6 months, 9 months.
I would pop into the house and do what I said, do the minimum and get back in the case. And every time I'd get ready to leave over these 2 years, my son, this little boy, would run out in the yard and he'd grab a rock out of the yard and he'd come running up when I'm leaving, "Dad, don't leave yet." And he'd put a rock in my hand. And for 2 years, I'd believed that my son was giving me good luck rocks, and I collected them. I kept one in my pocket all the time. I had them in the saddlebags of my motorcycle, my undercover car, my undercover house. I was handing them out to members of our task force. And we had violence swirling around us for 2 years. I think there was 10 murders, dozens of stabbings, dozens of beatings, all kinds of craziness was going on. And right before my last trip away from home, my last operation, I'm sitting on my motorcycle and I'm in the driveway and I'm getting ready to leave. And my son comes running up, "Dad, don't leave yet." And he gives me a rock. And I said, I'm a 40-year-old father trying to comfort this 8-year-old boy now. And I told him, I said, "You know what, Jackie, I'm almost done. And when I finish this, I got a little bit more work to do. When I finish this, I'm going to come home and we're going to do all those things that I should have been doing with you. We're going to ride bikes and play catch and go to the movies and read books and hang out." And I said, "It's because of all that good luck you've given me." And this little boy standing in the driveway in nothing but a pair of shorts, no shirt, no shoes, and tears start running down his cheeks. And he's like, "Dad, those rocks were just for you. And they're not for good luck. They're for you to put in your pocket. And every time you think someone is going to shoot you or stab you or hurt you, you can put your hand in your pocket and touch it. And that's like me being there to help you fight them back. That was the worst day of my life. That was the worst day of my life because I had brainwashed myself into thinking that I was supposed to be some super undercover agent. And I had this hero syndrome that I was out there changing the world. The reality of it is that wasn't my job. My job was to raise good kids, and I had failed them.
Hmm. Children do teach us a lot, you know, in many ways. When you did come back home after it was done, you know, were you able to spend time with him? Were you able to make up for the time and be the father that you wanted to be?
I worked to repair that battle damage. I have an amazing family. My kids, I have a 27-year-old daughter, and my son is now 23. I have an amazing wife. I say this all the time. I have made a million mistakes with my family, and they have given me a million and one second chances.
Getting back to the operation, Jay, one of the things that people always seem to want to hear about, what's a simple way to say that?
The reality of it is that it's what we term street theater. It is, we put on a play, and I did this dozens of times during this case, hundreds of times during my career, but this event that you're referencing was probably the most dynamic and the most risky. What we did is we faked the murder of a Hell's Angels rival. We faked the murder of a member of the Mongols motorcycle gang, captured evidence of our fabricated murder, and then delivered that to the Hell's Angels as evidence that we deserved membership in the gang. So in reality, what it is, these street theaters, whether it's that type of operation or anything lesser than that, it's inaccurate conclusions from accurate observations. That's the way I characterize it. I told the Hell's Angels that there was a Mongol in Mexico that I was aware of that was running his mouth, and that I wanted to go down there and kill him.
Inside Crime is brought to you by DeTerra. The DeTerra drug deactivation system is an independently tested, safe, and environmentally sound solution that permanently deactivates, destroys, and disposes of unneeded pills, patches, liquids, creams, and films right at home. Be part of the solution to reduce drug abuse. Learn more at DeTerraSystem.com.
I told the Hell's Angels that there was a Mongol in Mexico that I was aware of that was running his mouth, and that I wanted to go down there and kill him. And they completely embraced that plan. They gave me the gun to do it, the instructions as to how they would suggest I have it done. Then we went out.
And was that a real person?
It was. Our victim was actually a member of our task force, dressed up in the vest of a Mongol motorcycle gang member. We went out in the desert. We dug a shallow grave. We duct taped his hands and his feet, you know, behind his back. We used some Hollywood theatrics, some blood, and put him in this shallow grave and made it appear that he had been beaten with a baseball bat, then shot in the head and left for dead out in the desert. And then we photographed that. We took the bloody vest back. We had a very airtight story as to how it went down and why, and then came back and delivered that to real murderers, to our real Hell's Angels suspects. And, you know, that's a pretty perilous point in the investigation because we couldn't fail. We had to be tight and convincing, and the backstory had to fit the evidence, and everything was very well orchestrated because not only were we trying to enhance our credibility and impress the Hell's Angels that we were worthy of membership, but we were also implicating them in a murder, and we didn't know what their reaction to that was going to be.
And they bought it.
They did. You know, like if someone comes to me or you or to anybody out there in our audience and says, let me tell you this story about how I just murdered this guy in the desert, and here's the evidence, and you see the pictures and you see the blood and you see the physical evidence, for me or you, as we're running the other direction, we're dialing 911. With these guys, it was hugs and kisses and embrace. And one of the Hells Angels took his vest off and put it over my back and said, "You got what it takes. You took care of business. You've shown that you are willing to do what it takes to do to become a Hells Angel. Welcome to the gang."
Wow. Oh, gosh. Did that get you where you needed to go to wrap up the operation?
It depends on who you're talking to be quite honest. For me personally, I did not want to quit. I argued to keep going. My position was that after 2 years, we're finally in a position to really do damage on these guys by being a member. The clearer heads are probably, in hindsight, were right. They were like, there is so much violence spinning around you that we cannot, in good faith, allow you to remain in this role. It's only a matter of time before you are a victim of this violence that you've been avoiding. I argued against it as hard as I could. I wanted to keep going. I didn't care. I didn't care. To some extent, to be quite honest with you, I almost had a death wish. I figured, you know what, if I'm going to die in this case, I'm going to die doing something I love, doing something good. And when you get to that point, as a lawman, you become dangerous. You start ignoring red flags. You start ignoring the stop signs. You start losing your reason and logic and common sense. And then when you do that, you're not only a danger to yourself, but you're a danger to all those other people on your operation who are responsible for your safety and your cover teams, because you're exposing them to dangers and to situations and events that they shouldn't be exposed to. And to be quite honest with you, man, I wasn't thinking about my partners. I was thinking about myself. I was being selfish. And man, like any cops out there that are listening to this, don't become that guy. Don't let yourself become that selfish person who is motivated by their legacy or by their reputation, because it's not good policing. And I am not proud of that.
Well, it is understandable how that can happen. And I know this is not a correct parallel, Jay, but maybe for people, might be easy for people to relate to. If I kind of like, you're the player on the football field, and you're in it, you want to stay in the game, and there's your coaches, you know, outside looking in and saying, no, we got to go to a different play, or we got to change it up. You know what I mean?
That's an excellent analogy. Like, so much of my life is driven through sports. I was a sports kid. I was involved in sports as a young man, and I was a football player. And that mentality, that football player mentality of always get up, always charge forward, never give in, the game's never out of reach, don't worry about the score, just play as hard as you can until you can't play, go as hard as you can for as long as you can. That football player's mentality was translated into my life as an undercover agent, and I conducted myself the same way.
So it was 2 years, and then that's when they figured out what was going on, right?
The biggest tragedy in all this is that once my true identity was revealed, man, in flooded the death and violence threats. The Hells Angels had a contract on my head. They offered the contract to the Aryan Brotherhood, to the MS-13, to the Russian mob, and to 18th Street gang, street gang in Los Angeles. So I had, at a point in time, I had 4 or 5 international crime syndicates all holding verified, credible murder contracts on me. And then it spilled into my family. There were valid threats out there to videotape the gang rape of my wife. There was people saying that, like, we don't need to put a bullet in him to torture him. We don't need to hurt him to torture him. Let's go kidnap his daughter and torture her. That's what will hurt him. I ran across a Hell's Angel on the street after the investigation, and he told me to my face, he said, "You know what? We know you love that little boy, and we know where he goes to school. And when you're waiting someday for him to get off the school bus and he doesn't get off, think about this. He's with me, and think about what I'm doing to him." In August of 2008, my house was burned to the ground in a failed assassination attempt. I lost everything. Everything that we owned, everything, every physical thing that we owned was gone. All based on my work, all based on what I believed to be doing, which was to investigate and confront violent crime on behalf of the people, you know, on behalf of America. That was the payback. That was the reward.
After everything's all said and done, definitely that is an example of your life. You know, now it's all merged into one. You know, your identity's out there, your family's out there.
If you're hateful for me for what I did, I understand that. That's the cost of doing business as a lawman. But when it started bleeding into my personal life, and when my family became the targets of the violence and the death threats, that was out of bounds.
Do you ever just think about picking up and moving to, I don't know, Fiji, Tahiti?
The reality of it is, in today's world, with the internet and with all the ways we have to research someone, you know, literally, unless you're a CIA operative and you have that level of backstopping, you can't hide. You can't hide from anybody, not for any length of time. And becoming aware of that, I just chose to hide in plain sight in the minds of people who intended harm towards me or my family, and at least make them think twice that if something happened to me, people were going to know who the source of it was.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you sharing your story. I know that you have different reasons for doing it, but it is a hell of a story, Jay. And I know you've got, you know, a couple of books out there for people who want to know more, right?
I wrote a book, which was basically, like, to just go back a little bit, or just to our previous topic, I wrote the book No Angel, which was used to hide in plain sight. I exposed the story and what I did and what we accomplished. And it's for anybody that has read it or maybe interested in reading it, it's not a hero story. Most cop books are hero stories. Mine is not a hero story because I didn't feel, don't feel very heroic in it. It's a very brutal, honest story of that operation, the infiltration of the Hell's Angels. I wrote a follow-up book to it called Catching Hell, which has a bigger picture view of my life, which a large portion of Catching Hell focuses on the backstory and the after story and what happened when the Hell's Angels case ended, and the threats and the violence and the death threats and the betrayal and the abandonment and all those things that were subsequent to the ending of that case.
Got it. So two books, No Angel and Catching Hell.
Amazingly, and I'm very humbled by this, like, instantly became a New York Times bestseller. And I'll tell you why. At least my view of why it was so successful is that because of what I said earlier, it's not a hero story. It's a common man story. You know, I grew up in a blue collar family. My father was a carpenter for 50 years. He pounded nails for a living. My mom washed people's toilets who didn't want to wash their own toilet for a living. That's all I ever knew. And that's all I am. I am a common man who was placed in some uncommon situations and did the best I could. That's No Angel. And I think that's why it was so successful, is because people can relate to it.
People can relate to it. Yeah. Well, Jay, I mean, I know you say you don't like to use the term hero. But definitely what we can say is thank you for your service, all of those years of service. And now I feel like you're serving in a different way.
Well, I work with an organization called Safe Call Now. It's easy to find, safecallnow.org. And what Safe Call Now does is it brings attention and offers solutions to really to anybody, but focusing on first responders who suffer from PTSD, who suffer from depression, the use and misuse and abuse of alcohol or substances, for first responders who are struggling with the thoughts of suicide. All those things I experienced and was somehow, like by the grace of God, was allowed to survive it. And now I've taken my experiences and I'm trying to do something for this community to expose them, to let them know help is available, help is out there. There was a point in my life where I felt alone, where I felt like no one cared and there was no one that could or would help me. And that wasn't true and it's not true today. And I try to use my story to promote the solutions for people that are suffering from those issues.
Mm-hmm. I think when you talk about PTSD, it's very common for people to imagine that relates to people in the military coming home from, you know, being overseas and whatnot. But really, PTSD can apply to anybody who experiences a variety of things. I know, you know, we talk to firefighters all the time and, you know, they talk about that collective, you know, they're out on one scene one day and then it's the next scene the next day and they haven't even processed what they experienced the first day. Same goes for me. For years, I was a reporter a long time and, you know, just covering these tragic stories. One day it would be one tragedy and the next day it was something else. And that would have an impact as it, you know, it just kind of collects in your brain, in your mind, in your heart.
PTSD can affect all of us, no matter who you are, no matter what walk of life you are in. My trauma may not be your trauma. It may not be the next person's trauma, but we experience it. And then you mentioned the fire community. Man, it is epidemic in the fire community for those exact reasons you stated. It's cumulative. Every day, multiple times a day, they're seeing tragic, dangerous, risky events. And the old school mentality for first responders is suck it up. This is part of the business. Mm-hmm. And we're realizing, you know what, that's not a good approach, because it starts to seep into people's personal lives. And then PTSD is not a personal issue. It's a family issue, because it starts affecting wives and husbands and parents and kids and friends. And there's solutions for it. And there's ways to defeat it. And there's ways to combat it. And that is what Safe Call Now is trying to expose. Like, don't feel like you're alone. You know, for the first time, I think in history, I believe in history, last year, there was more lawmen, there was more firefighters who died from suicide than they did from on-the-job injuries. And that is epidemic, and that's tragic, and we have to do something about that.
Yes. Now, is Safe Call Now, is that set up to be a hotline that first responders can call if they need help? Or
it is, it's a multifaceted organization, but it's driven around a 24-hour hotline that is answered by people who are familiar with the issues encountered by first responders. People have called the hotline with a gun to their head who have received care, received support, received treatment, who are living, breathing, functioning, and thriving today because they made that call.
Through all of your experience, how would you advise, you know, family members out there who are trying to support somebody in law enforcement or in these various positions that deal with these situations?
Man, that's so hard, you know, because I was so abusive towards my own family. And I think patience and love and understanding and trying to relate to the pressures.
What are your words of wisdom to your fellow comrades out there?
Be courageous and understand that the world needs people to stand. The world needs people that will, that are willing to take a stand between the predators and the good and innocent, peace-loving people out there who either can't or won't do it for themselves. Man, go do that with all your passion and with everything you're capable of. Go as hard as you can for as long as you can. But along the way, don't forget to hug and kiss your family and your friends and tell them that you love them. There's nothing more honorable in my mind than having your community hand you a badge and hand you a gun and say, please keep us safe. With that comes an enormous amount of responsibility and pressure, and it creates battle damage. Just along the way, do those things. Do them the best you can. But man, love on your friends, love on your family, hug your kids, kiss your wife, kiss your husband, and let them know that you appreciate their supporting you, supporting others.
Jay, we appreciate you. We appreciate all of your service. We appreciate you sharing your story. We appreciate what you're doing now to help others stay safe. So thank you so much for spending some time, taking the time to spend with us today.
Thank you for having me on your show, and thank you to your audience. And be safe. God bless. And everybody out there, man, go do something amazing today.
And that's it for this episode of Inside Crime. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm your host, Angeline Hartman. For more information about our show, just go to our website, insidecrime.com. Also, you can reach me on Twitter. My handle is @AngelineDC. I would love to hear from you. And finally, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Inside Crime.